I'm not authorized to give out these awards, but certainly Judge Cook deserves an award for judicial temperament in the face of adversity. And in that regard, it actually would have been somewhat helpful if the court, a different court, the court that signed off on Mr. Rich's waiver of his right to counsel had done a little bit more to discourage him from making that foolhardy decision. Now, I think the court certainly adequately told him that he faced technical rules and the court would not be helping him during the trial. But Bellevue v. Acree, our Supreme Court, has said that at a minimum, the trial court must engage the defendant in a colloquy and ensure, at a minimum, that he understands the nature and the classification of the charges against him, and that he, probably most importantly, understands the actual prison sentence he is facing.
Mr. Davis, I think more fundamentally, from the colloquy, the get-go, the prosecutor, Judge Meyer, was not the trial judge, but was the judge who engaged him in a brief colloquy. But it appears that the state may have unintentionally misinformed the court about what the charges were, because I don't know if that is something that may explain why no one ever corrected the judge as the judge was engaging in his colloquy. In other words, the prosecutor said he's charged with a felony DUI with a license suspension. I mean, that tells me there's one charge.
I agree. And unfortunately, that was never corrected. And in fact, the written waiver of counsel that Mr. Rich signed, and which the court has before it, states in question four, do you realize that you are currently charged with, and a blank is left for the defendant to fill in the charges he says he knows he's charged with? And the answer, of course, that's written there is yes.
Does the it's pretty clear from the record that his attorney, Mr. Rich's attorney, filled out the form for him because he was handcuffed. Does counsel have any obligation to correct the record?
I think ultimately, Your Honor, it is the trial court's responsibility to ensure that any constitutional right waived in its courtroom is waived knowingly, and here with knowledge of the actual sentence faced upon conviction. So there may have been an error by defense counsel, but Bellevue v. Acree asked the trial courts, preferably by colloquy, to ensure for itself that the defendant is making this very important and foolhardy decision, in fact, understanding what his actual sentence is.
What if the judge thought, based on the state's comments, that there was only a felony before him? The form, the waiver form, doesn't say what the precise crime is that he's being charged with. What if the court assumed, based on what the prosecutor represented, that there was just the felony?
I think that the defendant's waiver would be invalid. The court did assume, or at least signed off on, a form which at best appeared to inform Mr. Rich that he had one felony. It actually didn't list the nature and the classification of the charges at all.
So are you saying this is an affirmative misadvisement?
I'm saying it is an affirmative misadvisement. And for that reason, the argument that's been made by the respondent, which is, well, you can go back in time and look and determine whether he had enough information to calculate mathematically his potential sentence, and also, I assume, figure out the SRA and its rules about consecutive sentencing. Because there was an affirmative misadvisement by the court at this Faretta waiver hearing, Mr. Rich's prior ability to perhaps have deduced what his actual sentence was isn't overcome. This waiver, this statement by Mr. Rich that he has been told that he faces 60 months, and he also says on page 3, understanding that this is the penalty, I am now deciding to represent myself. It's clear that he was affirmatively misinformed of the nature and classification of the charges, and in particular, the length of the sentence. And for that reason, his waiver cannot be knowing as required by the Constitution. This court has said And actually, Your Honor, Jordan joined in Judge Schindler's opinion, I think it was, in Thompson, said that this Court of Appeals, will indulge every reasonable presumption against finding that the defendant at trial waived an important constitutional right. The respondent's argument that the court should ignore this form, which the state proffered below, and instead look backwards in time is not consistent with that standard of review. So for that reason, we're asking the court to reverse and order a new trial.
How about looking forward in time? How about the state's argument that the fact that the misdemeanor's dropped when he goes to trial, that kind of blunts the impact of not having fleshed that out?
So the end result is somewhat different than the full six-year sentence, of course, and I think this court dealt with that situation in Silva, which I've cited, and that is the case in which Mr. Silva was not told that his sentences for the multiple counts could run consecutively, and the state argued, well, it doesn't matter because ultimately the judge didn't run them consecutively. And the court said, and I think this is correct, is that the question is whether the defendant's waiver was knowing at the time. And even though Mr. Silva was a particularly smart defendant, the court said that this information, his accurate maximum possible penalty, was essential to assess the risk of proceeding without assistance of counsel, and Mr. Silva did not have a benefit of an advisement to that effect. The consequence is that every day thereafter he was not represented by a lawyer, which is his right, and there had been no knowing waiver of that right. I believe that each day, including trial, was a consequence of that unknowing waiver. And I don't think the fact that the part of this sentence is constructed by a misdemeanor has any effect ultimately on the time that he was facing.
That's the question.
Well,
in this circumstance, really not subject to a harmless error analysis.
I think it's the defendant who has as much bravado as Mr. Rich, as to whom it's most important that he be told the actual consequences of going to trial without an attorney. I'll reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Melissa Sullivan, and I'm a deputy prosecutor for Skagit County.
My last question is the only argument that you have at your disposal this morning with regard to this waiver, on its face and on the record.
Correct. You're right in pointing out that Mr. Rich didn't actually face any consequence of having consecutive sentences, because on October 6, 2011, well before the trial commenced, the DWLS and the first degree charge was actually dismissed. So unlike in Silva, this case is distinguishable because at sentencing, Mr. Rich was not actually facing a consecutive sentence. At that point, he was facing 60 months in custody because of his offender score. And so any issue as to what consecutive sentences, if any, he was facing was resolved on October 6, 2011, when that DWLS 1 was dismissed by motion of the state. It should be pointed out that Mr. Rich did have an attorney initially at arraignment. He was advised of his rights at that time, and an attorney went over. Ms. Laura Raquelme was his appointed counsel at arraignment. He didn't set out at arraignment representing himself. So he had an attorney who went over the maximum penalties, and there was an information that was filed with the court and as part of this record that indicated to Mr. Rich clearly what the maximum penalties for both charges were. Now, it's true that a colloquy orally was not on the record as far as reading through that information verbatim to Mr. Rich to make sure that his defense attorney had actually gone over those maximum penalties with him. But we have to presume that someone who is representing him and making note on the record and representing that they have gone over these maximum penalties with him and are satisfied that he understands them, that they did that.
Are you assuming that counsel did review the maximum penalties with him?
Given her representation to the court on record that she did, I believe her.
She filled out the form, though, with respect only to a felony.
This form was filled out at a later date, I believe.
From when?
Well, this form was signed off on by Judge Meyer, and it looks like
the same date as the colloquy.
Yes, and it does look like it was done when he wanted to go pro se.
Is this the same lawyer you just contended adequately advised him?
I can't say that this is her handwriting, to be completely honest.
Since she was so careful earlier, the irony is that he's right about not being well represented to the extent that this isn't filled out correctly.
And he went on to represent himself and he had separate standby counsel, different and apart from the attorney that represented him at arraignment. A different attorney, Sharon Fields, was appointed to be standby counsel and was present for the trial to assist him in any matter he needed.
Who was his trial counsel up until the point of the waiver? Is it Requie?
Laura Raquelme was his public defender that was appointed to him. Initially, he did not want her to continue representing him, and he elected to go pro se. But then at the court's urging, that because the court did enter a colloquy, while it may be brief in your opinion, Your Honors, I believe you said that in the first argument, there was at least 15 pages of record of that colloquy via this transcript. So it's the state's contention that that's not a brief amount of time for a court to go over an individual's right to represent themselves. The court was...
At what point do you measure whether or not the waiver was constitutionally valid?
I'm sorry, what do you mean at what point? At this point we're looking at it.
You're asking us to look back to fill in the gaps. In other words, there's a rare exception to the waiver rule is if the record affirmatively shows that he had knowledge about what his rights were. And what you're saying is that at arraignment he knew it, therefore he must have known it on the day this colloquy occurred. Isn't that what your argument is?
Yes, I believe so. I don't think that we can ignore that he had his rights read to him, and an attorney stated on the record that she went over these rights with him. We shouldn't ignore that prior court hearing. It would be one thing if a person came before a court initially at arraignment, never having spoken to a defense attorney, and not having someone appointed to them, private or public, and then saying to the court, I want to represent myself. I don't feel anyone is adequate to represent me, and I'd like to go forward pro se. But that's not the case here. He did have someone initially, and that person made a representation on the record that they went over the maximum penalties for each charge. Also, this form, although it could have been better filled out, obviously, that's why we're here, there is mention that do you understand that these sentences can be served or may be ordered to be served consecutively? And it's the answer is yes. So this form wasn't void of addressing that issue. And that's on line number 8 that I believe appellant highlighted for Your Honors. And so if this form was completely void of that mention altogether, I believe that the appellant would have a stronger position. Coupled with the fact, as I mentioned previously, that the gross misdemeanor was dismissed before trial.
It was still before the court when he engaged in his colloquy with Mr. Rich, though, right?
There's no denying that. You're right. Yes. I mean, it was still filed.
Where in the form does it talk about the gross misdemeanor?
It says on line 8, do you realize that if you are found guilty of more than one crime, this court can order that the sentences be served consecutively, that is one after the other. It doesn't say -felony DUI and DWLS 1, but he was facing two charges here, and I think that that adequately lets him know that his sentences can be served consecutively. That's not the presumption.
What's the maximum for a gross misdemeanor?
364 days.
65.
And, well, there's been a legislative change for the one day less.
And $5,000 fine?
Correct.
Does the form advise him of that?
No, not specifically, other than the fact that he was facing two crimes. It does not write out DWLS 1 -364 and a $5,000 fine. I can't say that it does when it's void of that.
Do you want to address the alternative means at all?
As to the Petrick's instruction request?
As to the sufficiency of the evidence.
Oh, okay. Yes. It's the state's position that there is sufficient evidence that a jury could find beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. Rich was affected by alcohol or drugs or a combination of both.
What evidence?
The pipe found on his person at the time of arrest that had Deputy Bearden in his training and experience testified was marijuana that had been burned or appeared as though the pipe had been used, and that was found on Mr. Rich's person subsequent to his arrest for DUI. There are no tests here because Mr. Rich did not volunteer to participate in any field sobriety tests, and he also refused a subsequent request for his breath. Obviously, hindsight's 20/20, and in a perfect situation, there would have been a search warrant for blood in this particular case. There isn't. But based on the observations that Deputy Bearden made, as well as his training experience and what he testified to at trial, coupled with also the civilian witness testimony, the state is confident that there is sufficient evidence beyond a reasonable doubt that a jury could find him guilty of a combination of being under the influence of alcohol and drugs or being under the influence of alcohol or drugs. Unlike Martin, this isn't a
testimony from the trooper with all his training and experience. Is there, with regard to his intoxication and what he observed, in terms of any distinctions between influence by alcohol and under the influence of marijuana? I mean, does he have that kind of sophisticated training and experience? If so, I doubt it.
I don't think the record supports that Deputy Bearden was trained, for example, as a drug recognition expert. I'm not proffering that at all. He was able to make observations, and he does have training and experience in order to make those observations. But you can only do so much based on what evidence also the arrested individual will allow you to get.
You've got a problem. You didn't get the test. You have no distinction between his driving and any nexus then with respect to the alternative means. It seems to me that's what's missing.
If we didn't have the pipe, there wouldn't be an argument for that. But I believe that the pipe evidence is supportive. Thank you.
Beyond a reasonable doubt.
I believe so. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Davis, you have 3 minutes.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Mr. Davis, in any of the cases you cite, was it a circumstance where it was standby counsel?
Standby counsel during the trial, you mean? I don't know. I didn't to conclude that was something, that having standby counsel or about to be standby counsel at his side at the time of the waiver would affect the question of the knowingness of his very personal decision to waive the right to counsel.
I guess the question is whether or not what you argued earlier, you very aptly stated it in terms of what the Gideon concept is that once you've made the waiver, you're now without counsel. But if you're not without counsel and you have standby counsel, we can't necessarily make that determination, can we? I mean, is it existential, or where are we?
Mr. Rich was instructed, he probably violated this rule, but he was instructed that his counsel wasn't there to be his co-counsel. She was there to file things and assist with the rules, issues, and the mechanisms of the court. The standby counsel was not and is not providing any substantive assistance to the defendant such that... Well, and she's a potted plant like Oliver North's trial. Just very briefly on the paragraphs that I highlighted in page 2, he was told that if this case became a multiple count case, the sentences could be run consecutively. But that wasn't an honest and proper advisement because he is charged with multiple counts, and he is facing consecutive sentences. Judge Lau, Your Honor, said three things that I wish I had said, which is the relevant time is the time of the waiver, not the arraignment 1 year earlier. Bellevue v. Acree allows the court to fill in the gaps if there's no colloquy, but it doesn't provide authority for overriding an affirmative misadvisement. And, of course, Bellevue v. Acree says that the exceptions to its requirements should be doled out on a rare basis. On the substantial evidence question, can a beer, dripping beer from it on the floor of somebody's car that smells like alcohol, is not proof that the defendant was driving under the effect of alcohol. And here the pipe, which was never tested, is not proof that he was driving under the effect of drugs. It's pretty clear from the deputy's testimony that this entire arrest and investigation were focused solely on alcohol. The alternative means that based on drugs simply should have been not pursued all the way through to closing argument. It having been done so, however, the substantial evidence rule applies, and reversal is required for that reason. Finally, Your Honor, there is a greater remedy than these two issues we've just discussed, which is the insufficiency on the proof of four prior convictions that are comparable to local ordinances. Now, normally the state doesn't have to prove that to the jury, but in this case, simply under the law of the case doctrine, the state put that requirement in the jury instructions but didn't provide the jury comparable local ordinances. The evidence is insufficient, and Mr. Rich's conviction should be reversed with prejudice. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.